Shalom Rabosai, good afternoon. We're going to try to do the second half of Chazar Shir for Contemporary Halacha, Spring 2014. There's a lot to do today, and we'll move. So first of all, let's talk about Rosh Hashanah Shir, about wills and inheritance. So the first question is, do we have to follow Halacha? What about the secular law of the land in terms of whatever inheritance law there is? So is there Dina D'Machlus Adina? So there are two reasons why Dina D'Machlus Adina does not apply to Yerusha. The first is that we only apply Dina D'Machlus Adina when one party is a guy. So if it's a Jew against a guy, then we apply Dina D'Machlus Adina. However, if it's two Jews, which every Yerusha case by definition is between two Jews, Dina D'Machlus Adina will not apply. The second reason is based on, the Rambam has a drasha on the words Chukas Mishpat, that's spoken by Hashem in regards to Yerusha, Chukas Mishpat, that word of Chok sounds like it's not just a Mamanistik Adin, it's Isser Veheter, and therefore, if it's Isser Veheter, you can't do things how you want it, you can't make Tanais, you can't just write wills, you can't make your own Tzavaos, Shalo Kedin Torah, because it's Masna Masha Kasabat Torah. And we know that Masa Masha Kozba Torah doesn't work, so therefore, the Dina Yerusha of the Torah will be binding regardless of what secular law would state regarding inheritance. Now, in terms of halacha, the halacha is that if a man dies, his wife will not be Yorishim, his sons will get it. If he doesn't have children, his father will get it, his cousins will get it, his brothers will get it, his cousins will get it, but not his wife. The question is, and what the goal we're going to try to figure out is, how can there be ways that a man could give to his, how he wants? So let's start with this. The one case where we do find the concept of a tzava is the Gemara of Bava Basra, Darshan's the Pasuk, Yom Hanchilo Es Banav, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Broka says that you could make a tzava for Ben Ben Hayorshim, meaning, if you have a number of boys, or if you can, if there are people in line who are going to be Yorish Midin Torah, you can adjust the percentages that each one gets. There are two limitations. First of all, it could only be within people who are Yorishim. Your wife, you can't be Masna. Your daughters, you can't be Masna. But within Ben Min Habonim, if, again, the second Tanai is that it has to be articulated in a positive verbiage. You could say, I don't want so-and-so to get. I don't want so-and-so to get this much. You can say, I have 100% of my property, I want 25% to go to this son, 25% to go to this son, 25% to go to that son, even though one of them might be a Bechor. So if you say it in a positive way, for those who are anyway going to be Yorish, there, it could work. The problem where this falls short of Ben Ben Habanim, this Tzava that does work, is the Gemara is Mesupik, whether that idea of Rabbi Yochanan Ben Broka allows to be Morish to Ben Ben Habanim, however, you, based on the percentages that you choose for yourself, is that only for Shchiv Mara, or does it work for any, even for a Bari? And it's a Safek and it's Nivayda Lo Yivshita, and therefore we're not going to be able to use this mode of Ben Ben Habanim as a model to allow inheritance, to be, to write a will as you please. So, we're going to have to look for other ways. Before we look for other ways, let's just talk about the din of Bechor. Bechor, in terms of Pishnaim of Bechor, it does not mean that a Bechor gets half. It means that whatever, if there are 10 children, so all the children get 1/11th, and the Bechor gets 2/11ths. The Bechor, Pishnaim of Bechor, means they get double of whatever everyone else gets, but so it's 2/11ths to the Bechor, and 1/11th to all the other of the 10 children total. Now, within the halacha of Bechor, the din is that it only gets pishnai b'chol asher yimatzelo, meaning that which is muchzak b'yadav, and not that which is roi. So therefore, we have to figure out what are the parameters of things that are roi, that we don't have the din of Bechor. So the most important thing is anything that's a loan, an outstanding loan, the Gemara discusses, if he's not going to, it's not collected by the time the father dies, so that we assume is going to be ra'ui, and therefore the Bechor will not collect pishnayim in whenever that loan is repaid. Halach l'maisa, it's most important when we talk about money that's in a savings account or a checking account. Any bank account, you lend the money to the bank to hold for you, and they repay the money when you withdraw it. What happens if the person died while the money's in the bank? So that's all an outstanding loan. So that should presumably be ra'ui, and therefore there won't be a din of bechor. However, there, and that's exactly what the Nodav Yehuda and Rav Shefter himself holds, that it's a halva to the bank, and therefore it's ra'ui, it's not muchzak, and there's no pishnayim. However, the other achon, the Aruch HaShulchan, Regus Moshe, hold that since with a bank, because it's FDIC insured, you're certain, you are completely sure that you will be able to collect it, it's not considered ra'ui because of the certainty that you'll be able to collect it. Rather, it is called muchzak, and you can, there will be a regular halacha bechor regarding the bank accounts. Now, that was talking about bechor. Let's take this whole machlokas that we just articulated regarding ro'i and the status of the bank account and apply it to another topic. What happens in the halacha of Baal Yoreshes Ishto if a woman has large sums of money in a bank account and she dies, so is her husband going to be Yoresh that? So there's a machlokas whether Baal Yoreshes Ishto, let's assume that Baal Yoreshes Ishto is also going to have that limitation, the husband will only be Yoresh that which his wife has, b'muchzak and not b'ro'i. So what we just said, according to the Nodav Yehuda and Rav Shechter, since she's not in holding this money in the bank account, when she dies, her husband will not inherit it at all. Rather, her family will inherit it. And that's going to be very important, if, especially in the first marriage, in the second marriage, there might be children from the first marriage that are going to get the money, not her second husband. If, on the other hand, we go with Aruch HaShulchan and Gris Moshe, who say that bank accounts are considered muchzak because you're sure you're going to get them, so then it's muchzak and the husband will inherit his wife. That's like the story with the Unterman and his second wife. Next topic is that there's a halacha that the Gemara says that it's not proper to skip somebody out of getting his nachala. Lo teheva avor yachasanta. So the Gemara tells the story of Yossi ben Yoezer wasn't happy with his son who didn't become a big Talmid Chacham, so he left all of his money to the Beis HaMikdash, which sounds wonderful except for the fact that Chazal were not happy with that. And they say, no, it's not right. Rav Moshe says, if the kids are mamish, not religious, married to a Gentile person, the kid broke off ties for many years, extreme Agmas Nefesh, that is an appropriate situation to knock them out of the Yerusha entirely, but otherwise a person should, if it's a somewhat normal child, somewhat normal relationship, there it's not right to knock a kid out of his Yerusha. What about leaving for tzedakah? So when a person's alive, they're not supposed to give one a chomish. But before a person dies, we're not worried that he's not going to have enough to live, and he has to only give a chomish because he doesn't need money to live anymore. There's a pasuk that says, v'halach lefanecha tzedakah, which tells us that you should, you know, you should have the money go before the kvura, but the question is, how much money could you give in order not violate this din of being ma'avir nachla, like we saw happen with the Beis HaMikdash, which was wrong. So there are three shitos of how much a person has to leave for his children so as they don't, and not give tzedakah. So yes, leave for your children, not give tzedakah, so as though you didn't omit your child from the Yerusha. The Ketzos cites Chuvas HaGaonim, that you have to leave in order to not violate lo yavar, that you have to leave for your children, you have to leave at least 4 dinarim to each child. Everyone rejects that. Rav Tukachinsky suggests that you have to leave 51% to the Yerushim, and the other 49% that you could give to tzedakah. The Gris Moshe, Chasim Sofer, say that you have to leave a davar chashev for each yoresh. So whatever davar chashev is 10, 25,000, so that's what you have to leave for each child. And the rest of the millions, you could leave for tzedakah. So let's go back to the question that we started earlier. This is the next point. How can we, yes, leave to people who are not necessarily in the chain of Yerusha? So one way would be, if the father said something, mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. So if he said something while he was alive, so you want to do mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. The problem is that might only be if it's hushlash mitzchilaso, if it's placed in a trust account while the father was alive. That might be the only time that there's a din to mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. But if it was not hushlash and the money is still in the dead person's account, maybe there's no mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. So it could be another possibility. That could be let me just add one point. The things that I'm talking about now are not talking about giving to other children. I'm talking about how can I leave money to tzedakah. What would bind, if the halacha doesn't bind the person to give the money to tzedakah, it's the person's own decision, which is not like the halachas of Yerusha. So what binds the Yorshim to actually give the tzedakah like the father said? So the first was mitzvah came to Abraham Ace. He wanted to. But that would be limited. It's only if the money is put in a trust account for this tzedakah. Second possibility is if we could argue that when the father pledged the money tzedakah, it already became owned by tzedakah. How do you have that? That's the shaila of Amirasal Gaval, Kamisrasal Hedyot Dami, which I think we might have mentioned last time, is a question whether it only applies to Hektish, that if you pledge to Hektish, that's when it automatically became owned by Hektish Memela, or even by tzedakah. So the Beis Yossi says that it does apply to tzedakah, and therefore the second that the father pledges the money to tzedakah, it already becomes tzedakah's before the father died, and that's how, of course, the tzedakah will get whatever it was the will indicated. The Ramah, however, says, no, that's only by hektish, and therefore tzedakah would actually need a kinyan. If a kinyan wasn't done before death, then it will not become the tzedakah's. The third possible way is to suggest that there's a mitzvah of kibud avaim. A father said something that he wants the money to go to the tzedakah, so there's a mitzvah of kibud avaim. But the problem with that is that's not enforceable by, you can't be kofa that. That's just if the kid wants to do what his father wanted to leave the money for tzedakah, great. If not, there's nothing to do. Let's finish off this shir with the very important question, how could a father leave money for his daughters? The answer is through a shtar chatzi zachar. Basically, that works as follows. The father has a document. It's called a will. And he writes whatever he wants in his will, however he wants to distribute his assets. Then he writes a separate piece of paper that says, I hereby mishabi myself right now to me'achshav, for whatever detailed reason. I mechayev myself, I can't, $10 million to my daughter, and $10 million to my other daughter. Maybe $10 million to my wife, even though all those people are not supposed to be getting Yerusha. Now, it can't be that this gift will be chal after Misa, because ain't kinyan l'achar Misa. That's why you have to say me'achshav. But you could say it's me'achshav, but there's only a zechus gevir la'achshav lifnei mosi. If he says that, so what happens when he dies? There's an outstanding lien on his property of $10 million to all these women. And the boys who get the Yerusha, halachically, are going to have to pay all that money and end up with nothing. So he also writes a tnai at the end of this document of indebtedness, that however, if you follow whatever I outlined in my last will and testament, I cancel this indebtedness. So what will end up happening is if you follow the tzava, however he divided the money to the girls, to his wife, to whoever he wanted to, then there's no $10 million owed, then this would be a way that the Yorshim would at least get something, and therefore they'll be encouraged to, in fact, follow the will. That's Shtar Chatzi Zachar. Ramosha did leave a secular will. The question is how that would work. So the suggestion was that the Rambam tells us that if a person makes a kinyan with Dvarim alone, that doesn't work. But if there's a strong Gemir Stas, that can make a kinyan without a Maisa kinyan. So perhaps Rav Moshe was holding that if you say that if a person leaves a last will and testament, it might be like that very strong Gemir Stas, and it will be niknet to the Yoshim as he indicated, even without a Maisa kinyan. That's the end of the shir of inheritance. Let's now talk about the shir by Rav Shulman of hair covering. Shtar Chatzi Zachar. So, for me, this is the hardest shir to prepare. Just working through all the lumdas. The halacha is that there are two categories for which a woman will lose a ksuva. Not just for doing averus, but also for doing something that ruins the marriage. The two things are overus aldas Moshe, where she's violating Yisurim Doraisa, or making her husband violate Yisurim Doraisa, so they can't live together. And secondly, overus aldas Yehudis, which Raman Hagei Tzniyos, that There are no halachas necessarily, but there are minhagei tznius that are flouting what a modest Jewish wife should be doing, and that will also ruin the marriage, and they lose their ksuva. The pasuk says by sota v'paruas rosh ha'yisha, the Gemara says mikan, if they by the sota they uncovered her hair, they let out her hair, mikan shebenos Yisrael lo yetsu v'paruas rosh. Mido araisa, what is necessary? So it's a question what the word, the Gemara says a kalsa is sufficient for the daraisa mitzvah to cover her hair. Rashi says kalsa means a basket. We don't pass like that. We assume that kalsa is a mitpachas, a kerchief, a tichel. That's what's required midaraisa. But of course, mina das yehudis, which is the minhag etznius, require more than that. The Gemara then continues and says that once a woman wears a tichel, once she wears this kalsa, which we assume is a tichel, then she's fine. She did whatever she has to do, and she doesn't have to do anything more. The question is, wait a second, but if it's in the shuk, the Gemara asks, that's not enough. You have to do, we said that you have to do more, you have to do das Yehudas. If it's bichatzer, then you shouldn't even have to do that, which is going to be important in a minute. So the Gemara says, no, it's talking about an amavui. Well, what we just said from that Gemara's question on Rav Yochanan is that when it's in the chatzer, you might not need to have the hair covered at all. So that point, depending on, we're not going to go into details how to learn that Gemara properly, but that's a machlokas. Can a woman be bareheaded in the chatzer? There are people around, but it's a chatzer. You know, just the 3-4 families around one center chatzer. So that's a machlokas. The Ritva says, yes, she could be bareheaded. The way the Rif and Rabbeinu Yonah understand that Gemara is, no, it's aser to be bareheaded in the chatzer. Of course, that she can be bare. She does not have to cover her hair in the chatzer. And the Rif and Rabbeinu Yonah, which is the accepted practice, is that a woman does have to cover her hair with a tichel in the chatzer. What about in her own home? Well, according to the Rit, her own home is even more kal, as far as tznius goes, than the chatzer, where there are other people around, a few people around. So according to the Rit, that we just mentioned, that she doesn't have to cover her hair in the chatzer, certainly in her own house, she doesn't have to cover her hair. But the question is, what would the Rif and Rabbeinu Yonah say that you do have to cover your hair in the chatzer? What would they hold by something more lenient to Hainu in her own house? So this is a machlokas. The chatzer, the Chasam Sofer says that whatever was by a chatzer, so too by a house. If she had to cover her hair in the chatzer, which is, we assume like that Rif and Rabbeinu Yonah or Machmir, that you do have to cover your hair in the chatzer, so too she'll have to cover her hair in her house. The Igros Moshe, however, is more meiko and says, no, a chatzer, she has to cover her hair. But at home, it's even more kal, and a woman would not have to cover her hair if there are no other people there. Rav Shulman added, but he thinks that that would only be when the other people are not there, but if other people are there, then a woman ought to have her hair covered in her own house. That's the end of that point. One very small additional point. We mentioned this concept of Das Yehudis, which is the minhagei tznius that women ascribe to. Now, is that objective or is it subjective? So the Bach says it's going to be subjective based on the community. Because there's a Rambam who says that in a place where women wear redid, meaning a whole body, you know, shawl, a shroud that covers her whole body, then the husband, the din, sher ksus va'ona, ksus, he has to buy her that full body garment. Which is obviously meduik, that in a place where that's not the custom to wear, so she doesn't have to wear it. So that's where you see that Das Yehudis is subjective, and it makes a lot of sense because the whole point of Das Yehudis is that you're torpedoing the marriage. You're not going to be following whatever is the norms for tznius in a certain area. That's undermining the marriage. Fine, that's that point. The next point is, the Rambam writes that Asa Levanos Yisrael Latzeis Lashuk Barosha Parua. And the Rambam applies it both to single girls and to married girls. And the Rambam only says that it's Latzeis Bashuk. Sounds like anything less than a shuk, which is the most public area, she doesn't have to have her hair covered. That's, we're going to explain, the way we'll explain is that's only mean Hadin. However, Das Yehudis will extend that Din Mieker Hadin in two directions. First of all, we'll say, now does she have to cover Mida Raisa, she has to cover her hair, Pashuk. Midrabanan, she has to, let me not say, I'm sorry, not Midrabanan. Das Yehudis would require her to cover her hair even in a Mavui, perhaps a Chatzer, that was what we discussed a minute ago. And secondly, that it would be enough, that Das Yehudis would also say that covering her hair is not enough, you might also need, according to the Rambam at least, the full body dress, which is dependent on locale. Now, the next thing that we're going to go to is our goal is going to be to understand some the halacha of uncovered hair for Kriyas Shema, but we're going to do that in a few steps. The first point is that the way Rabbi Shulman learned the Rambam and perhaps all Rishonim is that when it comes to Kriyas Shema, the Rambam, he assumes, holds that kol gufa is an erva. If there's a woman opposite a person's eyes while he's saying Kriyas Shema, even if she's fully dressed, if her hand is open, that's an erva for Kriyas Shema. If her nose is visible, that's an erva for Kriyas Shema. The other Rishonim agree to that a woman's entire body is an erva. However, they hold that there's a heter of regilus, that even though the whole body has a din of erva legabe Kriyas Shema, however, wherever there is regilus that people are accustomed to, there it's to see that is permitted when saying Kriyas Shema. We, of course, follow the Rishonim that whatever is regil does not have this limitation, is not considered a problem for Kriyas Shema. Additionally, the Rambam applies this issue of that a woman's body is an erva even for the seyer of a penuya. So according to the Rambam, you wouldn't even be able to say Kriyas Shema if the seyer of a penuya was opposite the person. Now, let's ask a stira in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch. In the Shulchan Aruch, when it comes to covering hair, with hair covering in general, in Evan HaEzer, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, like the Rambam, that even penuyos, single girls, do have to cover their hair. However, when it comes to Hilchos Kriyas Shema, he says that you're allowed to say Kriyas Shema with a penuya's hair open in front of you. So I don't understand. What's the status of penuya's hair? Is it erva or is it not erva? If it's erva, so why are you allowed to say Kriyas Shema in front of a single woman's hair? If it's not an erva, then why does it have to be covered? So the Beis Shmuel suggests an answer that no. When we said that penuyos must cover her hair, it doesn't mean single girls cover her hair. It means women who are no longer married have to cover their hair. Almanos or grushos. That was a dachuk answer that had problems. We don't have to get into the problems. But Rav Shulman wanted to suggest another answer to this stira. How come the stira regarding the uncovered hair of a single girl, how come for the halacha, Shulchan Aruch says she has to cover it midin Evan HaEzer, but in Hilchos Kriyas Shema, you're allowed to say Kriyas Shema in front of it. Which, is it erva or is it not erva? So, to answer that stira, we have to build an important yesod. The yesod that we're going to say is that hair is not a makom mechusa. Hair does not have a din of a makom mechusa. What's the point of covering hair or the problem with a married woman not covering her hair? It's just a woman is acting in a way that's like walking outside without her wedding ring. If the normal way is that women cover their hair, so by a woman walking outside without covering her hair, that would be like a woman taking off her wedding ring when she goes amongst people, which is in a certain sense signaling like, hey guys, I'm available. So that would be the problem why a woman would, that's the reason why a woman has to cover her hair, not because it's a makom mechusa. Accordingly, that's how Rosh Hashanah explained, that's Pshat HaShetel. If it had a din of like a makom mechusa, so you have to give like a certain sneeze to that part of the body, so in the same way, you can't just wear a woman can't wear a skin-tight leather suit, she also shouldn't be able to wear a beautiful shetel, because it's like a makom mechusa, you don't want to attract attention. But if we say that's not pshat in the hair covering is not because of a makom mechusa, because it's erotic, it's because it's doing something that sort of shows, I'm available, it's like taking off a wedding ring, and therefore, that's why hair, a woman's hair has to marry, a woman's hair has to be covered, it has nothing to do with how pretty the shetel is or isn't. Now, with these hakdamas, we could answer the stira that we asked a minute ago in the Shulchan Aruch. The question was, a panuya's hair. You tell me that it has to be covered, but you tell me that for Shema, it's okay. You could say Shema opposite it. The answer is that since we're saying that hair doesn't have to be covered be'etzem, it only has to be covered because to show, you know, to show what she is, and one second, hold, give me a minute, please. The Rambam that we said a few minutes ago said that that a woman who goes bashuk, whether she's single or married, has to cover her hair. And we just explained that that has nothing to do with erva, it's just that it's making a point. And that's why, from a deraisa level, she could go uncovered. A married woman even could go uncovered in a mavi and in a chatzer. It's only midas yehudis that she has to go covered in a mavi and in a chatzer. Regarding kriyas shema, even if you hold that kol gufo is an erva, but there's a heter of regilas. So wait a second. If we just said that midaraisa, a married woman, only has to cover her hair in the shuk, but does not have to cover her hair in a mavui. So wait, for kriyas shema, there's a heter of regilas. And regilas means that you sometimes see her with her hair uncovered. So since in a mavui and a chatzer, you do see her hair, so it's going to be mutter to say kriyas shema in front of her. In terms of her obligation to cover her hair, that midaraisa applies bashuk, and that would apply even for single girls. So we answered the question was, how could a single girl, tell me that she has to have her hair covered, but yet you say that you're allowed to say kriyas shema? The answer is, she has to have her hair covered. That's bashuk. But since in a mavi and a chatzer she doesn't have to have her hair covered, then it's ragil, you're ragil in it, and therefore for kriyas shema, where there's a heter of regilus, the hair, you could say kriyas shema opposite a woman, a single girl, whose hair is uncovered, because she is your ragil to hear, to see that in front of you. Because married women, you're not ragil to see married women's hair, even in a mavi.
So, when do single women have to cover their hair? What's the bottom line?
We don't hold that way. The Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch says women have to cover their hair. Single women have to cover their hair in the shuk. That's what the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch says. You and I don't. We don't.
Do you know Ramah disagrees with that, or?
We certainly don't. Is it the Ramah say something first? I'm not sure. Rishon
Lezion said that
single women, there's nothing wrong with them flouting their singleness, because they are single. According to the Rambam, why would they have to cover their hair? I guess because since it's an accepted, I guess if there's a community where the accepted way of society is to cover their hair, then it's considered inappropriate even for a single girl to do it. It's a lack of modesty even for a single girl to do it.
So the regilus that we're talking about here, that matters by Kishma, is a halachic regilus or a literal physical regilus? Like, since halachically they could, I will be that they
no,
don't.
You see single women in the mavli. Really okay. According to Rambam, in the Rambam's world, single women in the shukar have their hair covered, but single women in the mavli have their hair uncovered, so you're accustomed to seeing single women's hair, so you're not turned on by single women's hair, so you could say kriyas shema wherever you might be, opposite of single woman's hair. A married woman's hair, you don't see her hair even in the shuk because of das yehudis. And therefore, you cannot say there's no heter of regilus for married women's hair.
If you lived somewhere where the panios were no way extra sneas and covered their hair in the maboy, you wouldn't be able to say kriyas shema.
That is correct. Okay. Let's talk about, you're talking about a community where everybody, even the single girls cover their hair. Let's talk about something a little more close to the home, unfortunately. What about a community where women do not cover their hair at all? So can you say shema opposite them? And this is soha lach l'maisa when you're trying to learn or say, daven a little bit on a bus in Eretz Yisrael, certainly where everyone's Jewish, America maybe, on the trains maybe not, but They're even Jewish on a bus in Eretz Yisrael, and there are even married women on the bus in Eretz Yisrael. And could you want to learn on the bus? So Mishnah Berurah in the Chazanish says it's aser. You cannot say Kriya Shema. Even in a place where no, the custom is women don't cover their hair. The Gris Moshe, the Aruch HaShulchan, Ben Ish Chai say a person can't say Kriya Shema even in a community where women do not cover their hair. That is the end of this shir, which was a little bit difficult. Now, let's go to the next shir. Do you want to do the halachas of Beis Din, Merkoz, or do you want to do contraception, family planning?
Contraception.
Okay, so Rabbi Willis shir on contraception, family planning, as follows. It starts like this. What is the mitzvah of Pur Ravu? There's a chakira. Will we say that the mitzvah of Pur Ravu is the fact that you have kids? Or will we say the mitzvah is to be boel, a person's wife, so that you hopefully will get kids? But the mitzvah, the maisa mitzvah, is that maisa bia. This, the Minchas Chinuch wants to assume, and we'll see three applications where the Minchas Chinuch proves that the mitzvah is to have kids. And we're going to see in those three cases that Rav Willig suggests that you could reject those three proofs, and Rav Willig feels strongly that the mitzvah pruvu is the maisa bia itself. Let's see the three proofs. Halacha number one. A person can fulfill Pur Ravu when they're a guy, before they're Megayer. If they're Megayer and they already have children, then they don't have to have children anymore, because they already had children while they were a guy. So Michas Chinuch proves there's no mitzvahs that he did beforehand. He wasn't Jewish. How can you say he fulfilled the mitzvah of kids? They had Jews, because the mitzvah is having kids. You have kids once you became Jewish. So Willick says no. Of course, the bia itself is the mitzvah. However, once there are kids and you became Jewish, there's no longer what's the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to have bia so that you can have these kids. But once you have the kids, then the chiyuv to do whatever you have to do, whatever the obligation. Since you already have the result, you don't have to do what the mitzvah is anymore because there's nothing left to do. So it's, again, the bia is the maisa mitzvah, but you don't have to do a bia to have children. You don't have to do a bia once there are already children here. So, what was the mitzvah not having the children? The bia was the maisa mitzvah. But once you have the children, then there's no point in doing the bias. He says that's the literal reading of the Rambam. The Rambam says, chayev liva until, before a person has children, chayev liva b'chol ona. That's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to be boel b'chol ona. And be boel b'chol ona is going to be the mitzvah to say. There's a mitzvah to shake a lulav on Pesach. There's a mitzvah to be boel b'chol ona. That's the maisa mitzvah. That's the first point. The second of the three points where you see this hakira of what Purabu is, let's say a person has a child, lives with an erva, and has a mamzer. So, the halacha is that he fulfills Purabu. Wait a second. Isn't that a mitzvah habah b'aveira? It's a mitzvah of Purabu that came through doing a man iser bia. So how could you fulfill the mitzvah of Purabu? Must be, says Melchas Chinuch, that bia is only a hechsher mitzvah, and we don't say mitzvah ba'aveira, we don't invalidate a mitzvah ba'aveira when the aveira was only in the hechsher mitzvah, in the bia, which is only a hechsher mitzvah. What was the real mitzvah? Having children. Was having the kid. The fact that you have a little kid running around, a little mamzerel running around, is that an aveira? No, and therefore there was no mitzvah haba ba'aveira. However, Rabbi Willig argues once again and says no. The mitzvah is clearly to be boel. Ah, oh, the bia was the iser. So how could you say that it's a mitzvah of Pur Ravu? No. It doesn't mean that you fulfill the mitzvah of Pur Ravu, and you're going to get brownie points, you're going to get a check in Shemaya for having done Pur Ravu. You didn't do Pur Ravu, because it was a mitzvah of Avera. It just means that you don't long, since there are kids now, you no longer have any chiv to have more children, because there are kids here. So, the kids are not the maisa mitzvah. The kids are just the sheer of knowing when there is still an obligation to have children. If you have children, there's no more obligation to have a bia to have children, because you already have them. That's the second point. The third point is the Beis Shmuel, Beis Shmuel Aruch, says that when a person releases seed into a bathtub and a woman gets impregnated, so he's considered the father l'chol davar. And the Beis Shmuel says, even to have fulfilled the mitzvah of Pur Ravu. Says the Minchas Chinuch, obviously, Puravu is not a Maisa Bia, because there was no Maisa Bia. What was the mitzvah? The mitzvah is the fact that he was responsible for having children running around the world, which is the case. So you see, it's clearly the mitzvah is having the kids, not the Bia. Rabbi Willig says, same party line. The mitzvah is the Bia. He didn't do the mitzvah. He's not going to get brownie points, but he no longer has to do Puravu anymore, because Lamaisa has kids running around, so there's no longer a chiyah for him to have that Bia. But the mitzvah, of course, was the Maisa Bia. That's the end of this section. The next section that we'll talk about is what happens if a person has children who are not meyuchas acharav, are not related to him for whatever reason, which we'll see. Did a person fulfill Puravu? So the halacha is that Puravu is only fulfilled if Zaro meyuchas acharav, if the children are ascribed to him. And we're going to suggest four situations where even though a person is the biological father, he will not have fulfilled his mitzvah Puravu because the children are not meyuchas acharav. Firstly, if a guy has a child with a Yisraelis, they're not related to him. So even if later he's Megayer, since the kids aren't related to him, he did not fulfill Puravu. Second scenario, if a guy had a child with a Shivcha, those children of the Shivcha go to the Jewish master, and they're not Miuchas after the biological father. So even if he's Megayer later again, still, the kids are not Miuchas Acharav, he does not fulfill Puravu. Third situation, let's say there's a Jew who marries a shiktza. The child of that union is not Jewish. It's not miyuchas after him. It's miyuchas after their mother, not their non-Jewish father. Even if he's megayer afterwards, he presumably will not have fulfilled the mitzvah of Puravu because the children are not miyuchas acharav. Accordingly, what would come out if we assume like Rabbi Yashu that by in vitro fertilization, when you have a non-Jewish egg donor, Rabbi Yashu says that the non-Jewish egg donor, she's the real mother. She's the real mother. So the husband of the couple provides his zera, and some third party woman provides the egg. Who is the mother? That non-Jewish egg donor. And therefore, the child will not be miyuchas after the person who's providing the zera, the husband in this marriage that wants to have a kid. And therefore, since the kid will not be miyuchas acharav, they will not fulfill Puravu. If that's the case, that providing a husband who's giving the zera so that his wife could have somebody else's egg implanted in her, if that's not fulfilling Puravu, so maybe he should be violating Hotzah Zera Levatola to provide that zera for this implantation in his wife. So Rav Willig suggested that we see from the Gemara that even if we know there's a concept of Sheves, even if a person doesn't fulfill Puravu, if there could still be a Kiyum of Sheves, so that might still be, even though he, the husband, didn't fulfill Puravu, because the kid is not Miyuchas Acharav, he still at least made children come to the world with his Zera, and that's a Kiyum of Sheves, and we see that for Sheves, Rav Willig suggested we can allow the Hotzah Zera Levatala. That's the end of that section. The next section is a halacha which can be very tragic. A couple is happily married for 10 years, but they didn't have children. So they don't want to get divorced, but the Gemara says, "Ein rashai lahashos, you're not allowed to keep a wife with whom you're childless because you have a mitzvah to do Puravu." So, according to the Dina de Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch sounds like you have to divorce her. So, how can we figure out a way to let them stay together because they are happily married even though they're childless? The Meshech Chachma asks, we're going to try to answer that question with the following yusod. Meshech Chachma asks, why is it that, at least in Hashkafa, that only men were mechuyav in Puravu? So he says, because childbirth is a dangerous situation, and you can't be, it's not, Hashem wouldn't be mechayav a person to put themselves into a dangerous situation. So for a man, it's not dangerous. For a woman, it is dangerous. So therefore, only the men were mechuyav in Puravu. Women want to have children, because that's, they're wired to want to have children. But they're not mechuyavos. A second answer, I don't know if this is Rabbi Willig's answer or the Meshech Chachma's answer, that the only reason why men are chayev is because, let's say, it doesn't work. He's not able to have children. Does he have to divorce anybody? No, he just could take a second wife and have children. However, a woman, what happens if she doesn't have children? Could she take a second husband? Absolutely not. She'd have to get divorced. So you see, Hashem commanded only men because Hashem is concerned that we shouldn't have to break up a marriage, a good marriage, to have children. So Rav Willig suggested accordingly, nowadays that there's Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, that a man does not have the option to take a second wife, so he will be just like a woman. A woman wasn't Mitzuven Pruvu because she would have to get divorced in order to do it. So here, now that we have Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, even a man who wants to have children would have to divorce his first wife because of Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, that he's not allowed to take a second wife. And therefore, perhaps also, at least in the realm of time of Dekra, he would not be obligated to divorce his wife, and he would no longer be obligated in Puravu and not obligated to divorce his wife. That's the end of that section. The next section is the mitzvah of Sheves and La'erev, that even after a person has children, they should continue having children. La'erev al tanach yadecha. The Ramban suggests that that's pasuk that says that you have to have children even when you're older, even after you've filled Puravu, to have more and more and more children. That's not a real din. It's only a good idea. Ke'ein yishuv derech eretz, but it's not really a chiyuv derabbanan. With that, we could explain the Rambam. The Rambam says that after a person has Puravu, his wife could be mocheles her ona. What do you mean she could be mocheles her ona? Her husband still has to fulfill this mitzvah of Puravu, of La'erev. The answer is, well, there are a few answers. The Pesachei Tshuva suggests that what it means is that after Puravu, you don't have to have every Bia B'chol Ona, but you could have the Bias less frequently to not have more children. As long as there is once in a while, you're still, that's enough to fulfill La'erev. You don't have to do Bia B'chol Ona V'ona, which is what you did have to do until you fulfilled Puravu. We could answer this question a second way. Again, how could the Rambam allow a woman to be mocheles her ona if there's, after Puravu, if there's still an obligation for her husband to have more children of La'erev? The answer would be that the inyan of having more children is not a chiyuv gomer. It's just, if you have children, it's great, but it's not a chiyuv gomer, and therefore a person would be able to say, I don't want to do that thing of La'erev, I don't want to have any more kids, that would be an option. Let's finish off this. Two more points in this year. A woman's meshubud to her husband to bear his children. The Ramah, however, cites that if a person has to get remarried, and he has a lot of children, it's going to cause fights if he marries a second wife. She's going to get in all kind of fights with the kids from the first marriage. So he's in such a case where it will cause fights, the husband is allowed to marry a woman who can't have any more children. Just like by Yibum, we discourage Yibum to prevent arguing, we encourage Chalitza. So to here, you could marry a barren woman so that there won't be fights. But wait, what if he is already married to this woman with whom he had the children? And there are going to be fights if they have more children. She's not interested in having. So perhaps we could extrapolate that same, if I'm allowed to go into a second marriage to prevent fights, so I should be able to stay in my own marriage to prevent fights. And therefore, once a person has two children, the woman could, it would be permitted to the man to not have more children to prevent fights. Even more so, we see that the Pesachei Tshuva paskins that once the person even fulfills Sheves, a woman has the right to drink a kos shel ikarin, preventing her from having children, because she's not mechuyaves to be mitzar atzma, because of her shibud to her husband, and he'll be able to stay married to her, even though he's not fulfilling erev. So therefore, once a man fulfilled puravu, theoretically, if his wife refuses to have more children, he's allowed to stay married to her, even though he's not having any more children. Rav Moshe says that even if she's a little weaker than an average, if she has harder pregnancies than average, then she could wait a little bit. Rav Moshe says that after Puravu, she's not just weak, but she's a sickly kind of person, she could also have the right to say, I don't want to have any more kids, because your mitzvah of La'erev doesn't obligate me to make myself sick. And Rav Willig wanted to extend this, not only if she's sickly, but even if she has a difficult, let's say one of the children they already have is a special needs children, then that tsar, a woman could say that I want to hold off. I want to hold off or not have more children once they fulfill the initial mitzvah because it's too overwhelming. In terms of after a person had a baby, the Chazon Ish was matur to use a diaphragm for 6 months, and persons say even more. Nowadays we think that it's not healthy to have another child in quick succession, so even up to a year afterwards. And here there's a question if Ramosh says that there's no such heter or anything more than that, or if Henkin is cites a minhag in Lita, that since the woman nursed for 2 years, for 24 months, and nursing is the natural contraception, so it would be permitted nowadays when we don't nurse as frequently. It might not be effective as a contraception, but a woman would be able to use contraception for 2 years after having a baby to space so that it will be healthy for her and the baby. In terms of modes of permitted contraception, IUD is okay, Mirena IUD is okay. If there will be a monthly drip of dam from the hormonal IUD, it would still be considered dam nidus, you'll have a regular nidus. The pill is mutter. Things that would be usr would be the use of a condom or surgery, which is serous, those would be usr. Just to finish off this year, the concept of when people get married to try to push off having children at the beginning of marriage before they fulfill the mitzvah of kruvu, well, the Rambam writes that it's usr, the Gemara says, lo yisak tana. And lo yisak tana, the Magamish says, even though soon she'll be able to have kids, but right now she's not able to have kids, you're not supposed to be marrying such a woman. Because the mitzvah is to live al b'chol ona, to have children. And marrying a 22-year-old girl who's on pills is just like marrying a ketana, because children are not able to happen. Finally, let's say, God forbid, a couple finds out they're married and they find out there are some genetic complications between their genes. So, Ramosha says that a woman is not meshubedes to her husband to endure tzar gadol for harbe shanim, and they would not have to, they could figure out alternate solutions they could use to avoid having that child. Shlomo Zalman says, an interesting svara, in terms of the husband, he has an obligation to have children. Why? Because he has a mitzvah zaseh puravu. But we know that mitzvah zaseh, you don't have to give more than one-fifth of your wealth. If the tzar that a father would have would be, if you had to quantify it in money, given a monetary allocation, would be more than a fifth of your wealth, you wouldn't be obligated in such a mitzvah. So if a person knows that they're a sex carrier, whatever it is, they would not have a chiv of puravu at all. Fine. That's the end of the shiur on puravu and contraception. The next shiur, do you want Bastin or do you want... orange candies or, blueberry pie. Oh, mezuzah.
Basting,
okay. Jari rolls. Appropriately. So the halacha is Rabbi Reese's shiur on basting and arkos as follows. The Torah says, Eilah ha-mishpatim asher tassim lefneihem. Lefneihem means the Sanhedrin. And Eilah ha-mishpatim means these rules you get in front of the Sanhedrin, which means that you can't go in front of a non-Jewish court, even if there are these rules. That means even if it's a non-Jewish court, will paskin according to halacha, you're not allowed to go before them. Even if it's eila hamishpatim, you still have to do it lifnayim in front of the Sanhedrin. Now, in terms of this din, this iser, this mitzvah d'oraisa to appear in court and not in front of a secular, in front of a beis din, not in front of a secular court, there are two reasons for that the Rishonim give. The first one is the very fact that you went to a Gentile court is miyakir shem elila. You're ascribing them honor by going to their court system. There's a second and different issue, problem, is that by using secular law, you're saying that Torah law can't deal with this situation. That's a chil Hashem. And there's an afkamina between them. Could you go to a secular court using halacha? The answer is no, because even though you're using halacha, by going to a secular court, you're miyaker shem elilim. And inversely, could you go to a Jewish court using secular law? No, because even though you're giving cover to the dayanim, the rabbanim, you're still being mechal shem Hashem, saying the Torah can't inform our life, we have to use this secular law system. That's an important chakir. The halacha is that even if both sides agree to go before a secular court, that would just be masa masha kos batorah, and the fact that the two parties made a tenai, that doesn't help. It will still be asa. What about the following case? Let's say we're going to go to Beis Din, but you and I will both agree that we'll make a tenai. Both of us agree that we could be judged by Beis Din to follow secular law. This is a gigantic machlokas. Sma says it's mutter. The Taz says it's aser. We'll leave it at that. Let's talk now about situations where I want to use a little bit of secular law. For example, as comes up in the prenups, women sometimes want to go to court because they think they'll get a better deal in court than in secular law. So could we institute lines into the prenup, for example, that would allow, that would be more palatable for women? Could we say that we'll judge according to secular law? Could we say we'll judge according to parts of secular law? So the story goes like this. There's a woman who got a gigantic dowry from her father. Father gives her $5 million as a dowry, then she dies. So according to halacha, who yarshins her? Her husband gets everything. But the secular law was expecting that, you know, maybe they were married for a week, and the secular law would have said it goes back to her father. He gave the $5 million to his daughter. She's gone. Take it back. So the Rashba said in this case something confusing. He has a bunch of paragraphs, and they all seem to say different things. First, the Rashba says that we should follow the umdana of what they were assuming when they got married. Then the Rambam says, oh, but to do what the goyim do, that's copying goyim, chas v'shalom. And if you do that, you're uprooting Hilchas Yerusha, we have to follow Hilchas Yerusha. And then he says, finishes off saying that if you make a tanai, you could make it whatever tanai you want, because you're making a tanai, but davar sheva mamon. So we have a Rashba that has lots of different, is pushing in different ways. So there are a whole bunch of mahalchim, how to understand the point of this Rashba. Again, what are we trying to boil out of this Rashba? To what extent can we use a secular law to govern an interaction between two Jews, if we agree on it? So among the mahalchim are as follows. The Beis Yosef says that the Rashba only says you're not allowed to go to Erkos. But if you want to go in front of a Beis Din, then the two parties can agree to follow secular law in front of a Beis Din. That's the first mahalach. Another mahalach to understand all these different directions of the Rashba is it really depends on what your motivation is. Is your motivation you want to do it like the Goyim? The Rashba tells you it's aser. If your motivation is you're just doing what the way we do things in this neighborhood, this is how we work, you're just doing what is the local practice, that would be mutter. A third mahalach in how to deal with this Rashba is that the Rashba is telling us that there's a difference whether a whole community is following secular law or you as an individual want to follow. You as an individual agree to submit yourself to follow this secular law. That would be okay. But for a community to follow accept a secular law, not like the Torah, that would be a problem. Rizal Nehemiah gives a fourth suggestion, that there's a difference if you want to accept upon yourself secular law or one prat within secular law. Meaning if you're dealing with a very specific point in Hilchos Yerusha, you want to just say that within Hilchos Yerusha, you want this to be the way the distribution of assets will work, that you could accept upon yourself. To say, I accept secular law, I want to be bound by New York State law. You put in a contract, we agree we're going to be bound by New York State law. Chas v'shalom. But we could say that we want to follow New York State law regarding the distribution of this whatever single point of New York State law, subsection 24, that would be okay. Another mahalach, with the same goal of how you could sort of find yourselves to a secular law, is that you can't say we're going to follow New York State law, subsection 24, section 8. What you could do is, we want to have the halakha that binds us, this point and this point and this point and this point and this point. Basically, you cut and paste it, all the details that were in that subsection in the law book. You cut and pasted it and put all those details into the contract. But you never mentioned the word New York State law. So therefore, you didn't, that's not a Chil Hashem. You're not saying I'm following the guy. No, I'm allowed to agree to have a certain way of adjudicating between us, if we both accept it. So that's why in the prenup, it doesn't say the words that we will be bound by, let's say, New York State law. It says, based on Rav Zalman Nechemia's position, which is, I think, the fifth one that I mentioned, or sixth, that we accept to distribute the assets based on equitable distribution or whatever other name. You're just giving it a name. You're not saying the word New York State law. You're talking about one specific prat, and you're not even calling it a law. You're just saying this is the mahalach, the way, the manner in which the system that we want to, the manner, not the system, the manner in which we want to govern our distribution of assets. That's the end of that section. In general, how do you make a Beis Din enforceable? A Beis Din, from a legal perspective, is an arbitration panel, and the best way to do it is to sign before two parties go to court. The Beis Din should have two parties sign an arbitration agreement, which binds each one to obey, according to the American law, whatever the conclusion of that arbitration panel is. Let's say you have a court case with a fellow Jew, and you know he's not going to, you know definitely he's not going to go to court. Let's say he's not religious, or you just know that he scoffs at Bat Din. So that's a machlokas if you're permitted to go directly to court, or you have to first go to Beis Din. You have to take him to Beis Din. We'll talk about when you're allowed to go to court, not at the end of this year. Before we do that, a cute little intermission is, let's talk about Mishpat Ivri for a minute. In Eretz Yisrael, they have this conglomeration of a little bit of Turkish and English common law, and maybe a little bit of Bava Basra Shmekling here or there. So are we allowed to be working with that system? So it is clear from all the great poskim that Mishpat Ivri is Isser Gomer. And Chavadas says explicitly it's even an issue to be a judge in Mishpat Ivri. Where could the whole concept of Mishpat Ivri even come from to say that you're submitting yourselves to this non-Jewish law? I mean, yes, we call it Ivri, that's Hebrew, not Jewish. Where does it even come from the fact that people might even suggest that there could be some binding, some power to Mishpat Ivri? So somebody suggested, Menachem Ilon suggested that there's a Rashba that talks about Dayanim Shebesturia. Rashba was asked, what do you do at a place where they don't have Talmidei Chachamim? The Rashba says, you pick three people who are wise and understand business, and they sit down and they judge to the best of their abilities. So, based on that Rashba, some have suggested, you see that they're not judging based, these people, Dayanim Shebesturia, are not judging based on Halacha. They're judging like three people who are wise businessmen. So you see, you don't have to follow Torah as far as Dayanim go. But that's rejected outright because the Rashi said, yeah, if there are no Dayanim, if there are no Talmidei Chacham who know any Torah, then this is what you do in their absence. Secondly, that's also said that they use their common sense. But if they're bound by a law system that doesn't let them use their common sense, they have to follow a system of law, that's Mamash Erkos. That's not Dayanim Shebesturia who are just allowed to paskin based on their own common sense. And even though there's a Meiri who says that they could look at you know the law books when they paskin, that's Meiri is just saying that if they want to be informed more, they're entitled at their own wish to look at the law books if they so desire to get a broader perspective. But to be in a system that you're bound to use secular law in the Mishpat Ivri, that is clearly awesome. If we say that it's us who go to the Mishpat Ivri and the law system and the secular system, does that mean that within our industry, we're contractors building buildings and we have our own set of rules, written or unwritten rules in our industry? If I have a contract, if I'm a contractor, you're a builder, you're a plumber, you're a welder, could we agree to bind ourselves to whatever the industry standards are? So the Kveger says that if it's a minach ha-sochrim, then it is permitted to bind yourself to whatever the minach ha-sochrim is. But not to secular law, just to the minach ha-sochrim, whatever the assumed way of dealing with things in that specific industry. Now, I think the most important part of the shiur is when are you actually permitted to go to court? We're going to have a bunch of different scenarios that you might be able that where there's a possibility of going to secular court. We'll talk about Rabbi Reis that gave a total of 10. We'll present 7 over here. The first one, the most obvious one, is you want to go to Beis Din, and the nitzvah, I take you to court, and you refuse to appear. I take you to Beis Din, and you refuse to appear in Beis Din. So there, I'm allowed to go to court. What's the source for that? There are 2 sources in Chazal. The Gemara in Gittin Peches says, "If I get meusa, Yisrael kasha of the kachavim pasul." And what do we do with the of the kachavim? Chov to nosel v'omrim asay mashi Yisrael omrim l'cha. So the Goyisha court we use the court as our strong hand, as our stick to get you to do what we should do. That's the first case where you could go to. That's the first source for going to court. Second, because he's not listening, we have to be ma'aseh the baal because he's not listening to us. Second source, there's a very enigmatic Gemara that says just 5 words. You call your friend, and he doesn't respond, throw him against the wall. That's the Gemara Bava Kamma. So the Rosh understands, what is that Gemara saying? It's saying if you call your friend to Beis Din, and he refuses, he doesn't answer, and he refuses to come to Beis Din, throw him against the wall, meaning take him to court. So halach l'maisa, if a person doesn't come to court, you can go to Beis Din, but we try to use, if I take someone to Beis Din, he doesn't come, we get a heter from the Beis Din. What's the concept of a heter from the Beis Din? It's not just like a permission slip to go on a trip or like to go to the bathroom in the middle of second grade, you get a permission slip. No, it's by the Chasam Sofer explains, the whole point of going to Beis Din, not going to court, is that you don't want to ascribe chashivas and value to their system, nor to their laws. But by getting a heter from the Beis Din, what are you saying? You're saying, I'm subsuming myself, subjugating myself to the Beis Din. The Beis Din, I want to do what you tell me to do, I want to do what Halacha tells me to do. So if they say, we, Beis Din of Hashem, are the ones who say, go to court. So, I did what I have to do. I wasn't Meir Miyad B'Toras Moshe, I wasn't Miyad Hashem Elilim, and therefore, I'm good to go. That's the logic of getting a heter from Beis Din. Now, another case where you're allowed to go to court is what happens in the following case. I take you to court, I want to sue you for something, and I lose. Can I now take you to Beis Din? So, that's 2 days in the Ramah, and the Ramah concludes that no, of course not. you did something wrong and you lost, and now you're going to try to make up the money by going to Beis Din? No, the Gemara Ramah concludes, no, I'm not going to take you to Beis Din. What about the inverse? Let's say I take you to court. I force you to court. I had no right to take you to court. And you lost. So you, who were pulled to court against your will, you want to say, now I want to go to Beis Din. So here we're going to say, Masham says, it depends on what your reaction. When I schlepped you to court, did you go kicking and screaming, saying, no, I don't want to go to court, we should go to Beis Din? Well, if that's what you said, so you said you wanted to go to Beis Din, okay, we'll take you, we'll hear your case. If I took you to court and you said, okay, so we'll go to court. So you, and the procedure started, then once the procedure started, you were silent in me taking you to court, then you gave up your rights to go to Beis Din, and Beis Din in that case will not be willing, even though you were taken to court and you lost, Beis Din will no longer, you didn't take the other guy to court, you were taken to court, Beis Din will not be willing to hear you, to hear your case. Yeah.
Not necessarily, I have to go to court.
Right. Third case where there's a possibility of appearing in a secular court, as we mentioned before, if it's Yadua, there's a chazaka that your opponent is not going to come to Beis Din with you, because let's say he's not religious, then you're allowed to, according to some opinions, you're allowed to go straight to the court. Some people hold you should still get a heter from the Beis Din. Fine. Next case, I think it's the fourth scenario where it's possible to go to court, is let's say the Beis Din paskin, and you just want to enforce the psak. The Beis Din says, yeah, he has to give you $100,000. You want to just collect that $100,000, so you're allowed to take him to court to collect the $100,000, because it's clear that you went to Beis Din. You just need to make it happen. Another case, there's a whole discussion, I don't remember what the conclusion is, but could you summon somebody to court, not because you're really going to go to court, but you just want to show him that you're serious so that he'll actually appear based it. Could you do that? So that's machlokas. That's a discussion. Whatever, don't worry about that. Halacha, just know that case. Next scenario is, let's say the chov barer. There's a tuition agreement that says, I'm gonna give this yeshiva $20,000 this year. And the person didn't pay the $20,000. That's a chov barer. He signed his name, I will pay it, and he didn't. So, there, the Ma'asham says, you could just take this chov barer to court and collect your $20,000. The problem is, life is never really so simple, and usually you think it's a chov barer, but the person who's not paying it usually doesn't think it's a chov barer. So that's a little complicated halacha maisa. The next scenario, the seventh case, is let's say you're not going to court to adjudicate a case, to litigate a case. You just want them to freeze the assets so that he doesn't, once the court case starts, he's going to, give them away to his friends, his children, send it to some safe bank account. So could you get a temporary a restraining order or an injunction to hold the money where it is? So Rav Moshe says that Beis Din can't do that anyway. So what's the point of going to Beis Din to get a court order, to a restraining order, to keep the money where it is, freeze his assets? Beis Din doesn't have the ability to do that. So there, court does, so go to court and get yourself and freeze his assets. Technically, that doesn't always work so well, because whatever reasons. Finally, if you have to bring a goy to court, you don't have to bring a goy to Beis Din. If a goy wants to go to Beis Din, you have to go with the goy to Beis Din. But in general, when a goy doesn't want to go to Beis Din, then of course you can go to court if the interaction is with the goy. And of course, the bottom line is that if you could settle it, whatever disputes you have with whoever you have on your own, just settling it, you don't have to go to court or Beis Din. So that's always a wonderful solution. Okay. The next, let's do Shechita. And then we just have Mezuzah. Shechita is going to be quick. I am going to add a little bit more than what Rebbe Chaim was. Rebbe Chaim had a Beis Din appointment that day, so we had to cut the shiur short. So I am going to add a little bit more than what he said that I would like you to be responsible for. Because the ABC of Shechita, and also things that were taught by Rabbi Elkin in the Shlachtos. Okay. So in terms of Shechita, you have a knife. In order to sheft, you have to do 12 bedikos to the sakin. How do we get 12? Because you have to check with your nail and with your skin, with the finger. And you have to go back and forth. And there are three sides to the blade. There's the right side, the left side, and just the flat, the bottom of the blade, the sharp, the point of the blade, the bottom part of the blade, where you actually do the cutting. So if you do your math, you have back and forth, both on the knife, both on the nail, and the flesh, that's 4, times 3 different sides, you get 12 bedikos to the sakin. The reason why you have to check on your flesh is because we want to see that when you cut the veshet, which is soft, like your flesh, it will go smoothly. And the reason why you have to check on your nail is because when you cut the kane, the windpipe, which is hard, it's cartilaginous, I don't know if that's the right way of pronouncing it, you want to make sure that it will also be not pogrom, so you check both the finger and the nail for the kane and for the veshet. Now, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that I think is like the simple reading of the Gemara, that if you have a blade that doesn't have a pagam, you have a blade that doesn't have any nicks in it, it's just dull. It's smooth, but dull. It's not a sharp blade. So Shulchan Aruch says that's kosher. The Ramah says we're not bekiyim, and therefore we don't do that. In general, the perspective that you should have when it comes to Shechita is that the Shulchan Aruch always follows what the Gemara says, and the Ashkenazim are always 10 times more machmer than that. That's just comes across many times in the Shechita, and the Rabbi Ben Chaim is always very happy to point that out very clearly. After Shechita was done, it is an absolute chiyuv to check that both Simanim, the Kana and the Veshet, were cut, because before you did the Shechita, the animal was becheskes iser, becheskes different ways to say it. In a tzavuach or even a chayah, however you want to say it. So you can't take it out of its cheskes iser until you do a bedika to ascertain that it left its cheskes iser. Similarly, after the shechita, you have to do a bedika on the knife to make sure it wasn't nifkam in the entry. Now, the next part is what we're going to do that you didn't have, that Rav Ben Chaim did not discuss explicitly. He did last year. Therefore, I'm going to present it to you now as easily and simply and clearly as I can. The Torah says that you should shecht an animal kasher tzivisicha. The problem is, there's nowhere else in Chumash where Hashem tells us how. So what does Hashem mean kasher tzivisicha? Obviously, there were halachas l'moshe mi-sinai that were not written in Torah Shebichtav of how to do a shechita, and what are they? They are the five halachas of shechita. I'm now going to tell you the five psulim of shechita, and this is the ABC of becoming a shochet. Number one is that there cannot be a shehiyah. Now, there's a machlokas, what kind of shehiyah, pause, was involved in the midst, like you're shechting back and forth, and you pause. So the Shulchan Aruch says that, like the Gemara, that the pause that's going to passel the shechita is the amount of time that it takes to lift the animal, fill the animal down, and shecht it, which is apparently 22 seconds. The Ramah, however, says even a mashu of time, if you're doing a shechita and you pause for a mashu of time and continue, that itself will passel the shechita for Ashkenazim. Second psul is called hadrasa. Hadrasa means instead of horizontal pressure, going back and forth. Of course, you always have to press down a little bit as you're going back and forth. But to come with pressure from top downwards, like a guillotine. You take a knife and you do a karate chop to cut off its head. That's hadrasa. That's a psul. Halacha mashim sinai daraisa. Just, by the way, keep in mind that as far as what material is kosher for shechita, the Gemara says clearly, bakol shochatin, last year of Ben Chaim told the story, that he was in the Sinai Desert when he was in the army. He was in the Sinai Desert, and he was with his Chilani soldiers, and they were hungry. So they took some chickens, bit off the heads, and cooked them. And he said, guys, Bakol Shochten, not religious soldiers. He said, guys, just they found some piece of glass somewhere. I don't know, took a Snapple bottle, shattered it, took a piece of glass. And with a little glass, he just did the shechita with that, because Bakol Shochten. So that was a cool army story that happened not to me, but to somebody who's in the army. Okay, the next of the five is chalada. Chalada means, well, two ways to look at it. It means that you can't, the knife has to come, you know, you from the top, and you can't sort of poke into the side of the neck between the two simanim and work from there, up or down. You can't poke when you do your shechita. That's how Rove Rishonim assume, but we are machmir. Not only can you not poke, but you can't even let the knife sort of get entwined in the anywhere in the skin or in the wool. You always have to be on top of the neck. Not only that, but chalada also is applied. I think the Ramah applies. Not only does it have to be that the knife is clearly on top, it also has to be that the makom hashlita can't be covered over with anything. So for example, you lean over to shecht and your tie goes over the neck, you can't shecht because the tie was covering over the makom hashlita, that would also be a psil of chalada. That's the whole point. Well, you have a square knife, because if you had a pointy knife, there might be a possibility that you'd enter from the edge, from the insertion, and that's going to be a psil of chalada. So we put a blunt wall over there, so you can't poke at all. You have to come from the upper side of the neck and do your back and forth motion. That was the third. The fourth psul is hagrama. Hagrama just means one very simple thing. Getting the right place on the neck. If you have a giraffe, you have 6 feet to get, and you don't have to worry about hagrama unless you have really, really, really bad aim. Obviously with other animals, you have, okay, a little less, you have, I don't know, a few inches, whatever the measurements are, I'm not a shochet. The Ramah is machmir that even if part of the knife went out of the permitted area, even that would be a psul. The fifth and final psul with shechita is the ikur. Ikur means that we have to ascertain, after shechita, you have to ascertain that the kana and the veshet in the neck, we're still attached from the I don't know, ligaments or muscles on the side to the face and to the neck, to the cheek, wherever they're supposed to be attached. If they were detached, loosened, disattached from wherever they were supposed to be held, inside the cranial, whatever you want to call it, maxfacial, cranial, whatever, that neck cavity area, that will be a psolik ikur. So ikur means that the simanim were still attached to the lechi and the basar, and the way they do it is that they check, after the shechita, they sort of, you pull a little bit. You pull after the simanim were cut, the kind of vegetables were cut, you hold them, and you pull. If they're still attached, what will happen if you pull something that's still attached to here? It'll pull back, because it's still attached, so it'll spring back. If you pull it, and it stayed pulled, that means that they were disattached from the cheek, or the wherever they were attached, for the neck, where they were supposed to be attached, that would be a psul of ikur. Now, just this is yes, I think from this year. In terms of hilchos treifos, in general, midaraisa, one is not obligated to check for any treifos whatsoever in an animal after shechita, because al pi rov animals are not treif, do not have sicknesses. However, and the proof is from paraduma, because when we do a paraduma, what do we do after we shech the paraduma, which is only kosher if it's not treif? What do we do with the paraduma? We burn it, and we don't check anything, not even the lungs. So that's the proof that you don't have to check for trephus. However, since the most common trephus is found in the lungs, so we check the lungs. However, what happens if the lungs were lost? Since I just told you a minute ago that miyikra, then you don't have to do any checking at all because al pi rov, the animals are not trephus. If the lungs were lost and you didn't get to check them, the animal will still be kosher. Now, let's talk about glot. What is glot? So, the Shulchan Aruch and the Rashba say that if a lung has a sircha on it, a lesion, an adhesion, some kind of string that connect, that goes, not supposed to be there, from the lungs to the side, inside of the animal, that's called a sircha, that makes it treif. That's what the Mechaber says. And therefore, you have to have a lung that doesn't have any adhesions to it. If it does, if it is like what I just said, that it doesn't have any adhesions, you have a lung that doesn't have any things on it, sitting on it, attached to it, that is called Chalach Beit Yosef, Glat Beit Yosef, that is the best. There comes Ramah and says, wait a second. It's not so simple. It's not just all or nothing. There are things called Sirchas, that's what the Mechaber is talking about. There's also something called a rear. Some smaller, more easily removable adhesion. So the Ramah says, if you just smush it with your fingers and it just sort of crumbles, it just disintegrates, that's only a rear and it's kosher. If it stays, that's a Sircha, and that's really not good. So, colloquially, what is glot? If you take out a lung, and there are no lesions, no adhesions on it, it's chalak, it's smooth, beis yosef, that's great. If it has something on it that you could sort of crumb with your fingers, so that's called glot for the Ramah. That's what your kosher Ashkenazi glot stores sell. And if they find up to three of these sirchas that can be removed with the finger, they'll call it glot. If there are more than three, or you have to get more involved than just crumbling it with your fingers, that will be not glot. That will be called kosher. Kosher is problematic. Kosher means you have to scrape it off, and that's really, whatever is not glot is really bad. So what we call kosher is significantly problematic. I saw online, I was just confirming, just going through some details, the Heinemann and the Star K website writes that in America, any chicken that has any lesions on its lungs, we just throw out. We don't even check the lung. We don't even check if the lesion comes off or not. So any chicken that is sold in America is by definition glot. And therefore, there's no reason for anyone to advertise glot kosher chicken, because if it's not glot, they wouldn't be selling it. In Israel, there's some Newcastle disease, and they do check the lungs, and check to see what kind of sirchas are on the lungs. And there, the Mahajan Hashgachas will make sure that it's glot, and the non-Mahajan Hashgachas will accept it as long as it doesn't have too significant a sircha.
So less lesions is glot?
Small lesions, rears.
Three then?
Even up to three, they'll be mashed up to three to consider it glot. If it's more than three, or if any of them are hard, that won't be glot anymore. Okay, one should we go? One should we go or two should we go? We have to do mezuzah and ribbis. Okay. What do you want to do first?
Mezuzah.
Mezuzah. Okay, so the halacha of mezuzah is that any room that has 4 amos by 4 amos, which in English is 7 foot 3 inches by 7 foot 3 inches, is chayav in a mezuzah. What happens if you have not 4 by 4, but you have 8 by 2? So here we have machlokas. The Rambam says 8 by 2 is chayav, but the Rush says no, you need a minimum of 4 amos on each side. Any room that's less than 4 amos by 4 amos will not get a mezuzah. So what do we do, halach l'maisa? Well, if you have a room that's smaller than 4 amos by 4 amos, let's say you have a hallway that's, I don't know, 8 by 2, for example, so we put a mezuzah, but without a bracha. The Taz and the Chazmish passes like this Taz holds no. If it's 7 by 2, no one would be, no one, even the Rambam, wouldn't require, even the Rambam wouldn't require mezuzah if it's, if you don't have 4 by 4. So, according to the Chazon Ish, who's making like this Taz, a narrow hallway that's not 4 amos wide would not even need a mezuzah at all. We do it without a bracha. Fine. Now, that's the first point. Second point, how do you use this room? When we say 4 by 4, maybe that's only, says the Chamud de Daniel, maybe that's only for a base Dira. Dira needs 4 by 4. But if you have whatever other kind of room that is not used for Dira, for example, you have a Mirpeset, a base Sha'ar, where you have like a guard booth or something, or a Gina, that the purpose is not used for Dira, maybe it should have its Chashivas even for less. It's functional even for less than 4 by... It's a function room for whatever its goal is. You know, a security booth is functional even if it's not 4 amos by 4 amos. And therefore, it would be obligated, says the Chamud Daniel, even less than 4 by 4. According to this, if you have an anteroom, right, your apartment has an anteroom that goes into the dining room, like mine does in the Heights, so that anteroom is fully functional for whatever it's supposed to be as an anteroom, so it would get a mezuzah, even though it doesn't have a... It doesn't have 4 by 4, so to be machmir for the Chamud Daniel, we could put a mezuzah there, but without a bracha, because it doesn't, it's not ultimately 4 by 4. Similarly, if you have a walk-in closet is fully functional. If it's a reach-in closet, then there's no derech biyascha, it doesn't need a mezuzah. But if it's a walk-in closet, so you don't live there, you park your shoes and your wardrobe and your makeup, whatever else, your pocketbooks. So that is a room, but it's not a room where you have, that's a base dira. So perhaps that would be chayev, and the Chamud Daniel says that you would be mechayev a walk-in closet, even if it's less than 4 by 4 amos. Do we pass like this, Chamud Daniel? So, in Rav Aaron Feldman's son, Sefer, on Hilchas Mezuzah, he says that when it comes to anterooms or hallways, we do accept the Chamud Daniel to put up a mezuzah, without a bracha. But for closets, it's not accepted to put up. This Chamud Daniel's Chumra is not accepted to put up a mezuzah. Now, let's talk about closets from a different perspective. This is the next point. The Mikveger says that you walk into a closet, right? The closet doesn't have 4 by 4, so it doesn't have a mezuzah. Wait a second. But if you're inside the closet, walking into the room, so your room has 4 by 4, so you should need a mezuzah on the closet going from the closet into the room. That's what the Rebbe Kveger says. So, there are those who hold like this, that therefore you would need a mezuzah on a walk-in closet going from the closet into the room, on the right side from the closet into the room. Sounds a little funny. That's Rebbe Yashiv holds like that, Rebbe Willig holds like that. But Rabbi Simon doesn't think that that makes sense, because in Hilchas Mezuzah, there's a big yisod called Derech Biyascha, the way you walk. There's something called forward and something called backwards. Backwards is not Chayv Mezuzah, Derech Biyascha is Chayv Mezuzah. If you're worried that we're always going to look at rooms from two directions, that undermines this whole yisod of Derech Biyascha. There's only one coming in and one going out. The Torah says, put in the Mezuzah on the going in. If the going in isn't Chayv Mezuzah, so why should the other... We don't say backtracking is also called Derech Biyascha. That's Yitziyah, not Biyah. In general, so let's say you have this, both the Chamud Daniel and Rabbi Kveger are both chumras. Rabbi Simon prefers the Chamud Daniel, who said that if a room has its purpose, even if it's smaller, Yishlepim says he prefer that he holds that more than he holds from the Rivik Reger, as we just mentioned, that you put a mezuzah going out of the closet into the room. In general, a person should just know, next point, that you never ever put a mezuzah on both sides of the door. Similarly, if you were to put two mezuzahs on one side of the door, that would be baltosef. Next, very important point, which is especially in the Heights, not just in the Heights, if you have a doorway without a delis, the Rambam says it does not get a mezuzah. We're machmir for others who don't hold like the Rambam to put on all doorways, even if there's no actual door there. So all of our dining rooms, our living rooms, we put mezuzahs, according to the Rambam, those should not get a mezuzah. And therefore, even if we will put up a mezuzah there in all of our dining rooms, living rooms, kitchens, which don't have doors, however, we will certainly not say a bracha to be choshesh, b'shitas, a Rambam. Next point. Let's now talk about how high on the mezuzah, on the doorpost, must the mezuzah be placed. So, the halacha is that if you place the mezuzah in the wrong place, you're not yotzei at all. So if you put it on the wrong side of the door, if you put it below the shlisha elyon, that's where it has to be, in the shlisha elyon, the upper third of the height of the doorpost, or if you put it too high, if you put it within a tefach of the lintel on top, the top tefach of the mezuzah, you're not yotzei the mezuzah at all. Ideally, the mezuzah should be placed on the bottom of the shlisha elyon, the upper third. What happens if it's a very, very tall door? So a door is 20 feet, 30 feet high. So Yushalmi says you should put it at shoulder height. That sounds l'chora like it's against the Bavli, because Bavli said shlish elyon, and the Yushalmi is saying that it's shoulder height. Chazir says no. The Bavli and the Yushalmi are saying the same thing. When the Bavli says shlish elyon, you know what the Bavli is trying to say? The Bavli is saying do the shlish elyon because shlish elyon is normally around shoulder height. If it happens to be that the shlish elyon is much higher because it's a crazy door, so weiter, do it at shoulder height. That's the Chazanish's way to say that you always follow shoulder height, regardless of how door the door actually will be. So in our kitchens in Washington Heights, we have a lot of situations where you have a doorway, but the cabinets, doorway is wide, and the cabinets sort of close up part of the doorway. So the bottom part of the doorway is filled by cabinets, and then there's at the countertop, let's say 3.5-4 feet up, 3.5 feet up, there's a wider open space till the top of the lintel. The question is, what's the shlish ha'elyon? The shlish ha'elyon of the counter, which is around here, or of the full doorway, the full height of the doorway, which would be, you know, at my shoulders. So, this, I think, according to what we just said, it's chazanish, that you should always follow shoulder height. According to some others, you'd put it on the upper part of the cabinets, without going into the details. Now, in general, whenever I place my mezuzah on the doorway, I want it to be closest to the outside. Why? Because within the width of the doorway, let's say my doorway is 6 inches wide, I want it to be on the inch closest to the street, because the mezuzah gives shmira, so I want to give as much shmira for as much area of my house as I can, so I put on the most outer bit of my house, of the doorway, to get the most shmira. Now, the next, in terms of leaving mezuzahs, when you move out, this shaila, I get very often, and I got one two nights ago, I think. So I said, let me just open up my notes from my Simon's shir, which I was chazing just a few minutes earlier. It was still open on my Google tab. I didn't have to open up the folder. The point of not taking the person said you're not supposed to take off the mezuzahs when you leave if another Jew is coming in, because you don't want to take away his shmirah. The Ramah, however, says that you're allowed to charge. And Rabbi Simon understood that according to the Ramah, if he doesn't want to pay, you can't take it with you. I don't know if that's clear in the Ramah. I saw somebody, Daniel Elstan, just show me the Aruch HaShulchan that yes, you could charge. What happens if he doesn't, the new guy who's moving in after you doesn't want to pay? Aruch HaShulchan says you have to leave him there anyway. Yeah, ask him for money. Say, I demand you pay me. If he refuses, then you have to leave him anyway. Rabbi Abadi says that if you don't know who's going to move in and who you're going to be able to collect the money from, then you may take it. I'm not sure if the Aruch HaShulchan, if you know it's Jewish, I'm not sure the Aruch HaShulchan will agree with that. I'm sure. Okay. Now, finally, we're up to the last shir in Contemporary Halacha 2014. Halachs of ribbis with a lot of contemporary applications. So there's ribbis deraisa and there's ribbis derabbanan. Ribbis deraisa is kitzutza, it's set at the time of the loan, how much or what the interest rate will be given as interest, and if a person violates and pays that interest, it will be yotzei b'dayanim, it could be collected, you could get it back. If it's only ribbis derabbanan, which there are lots of ways to make it derabbanan, it is not yotzei b'dayanim, although you should return, if you collected interest midrabbanan, midina, no one's going to be able to take it away from you, but you should pay it back. It's important to realize that when it comes to ribbis, not only the lov and the malveh violate the issur d'oraisa of ribbis, and again, we're not talking about lifnei iver now, we're talking about the issur d'oraisa of ribbis, of los hasimon alav neshach, but also the edim, the sofer, in other words, the lawyer who writes the contract between two Jews with an interest clause, with any clause that has interest involved, the lawyer himself will be violating the issur d'oraisa of ribbis. However, these ancillary parties, the sofer, the edim, the lawyer is only going to be a violation of the daraisa when it comes to ribis ketsutza daraisa, but by ribis drabanan, the yisurim of ribis drabanan only apply to malve velovis. If a lawyer has a complicated commercial case where, for whatever reason, which we'll talk as we go, it will only be an issur of ribis drabanan, he can draft that contract as long as you get out of the lifnei iver issues. It's of course important to remember that we're not talking about Choshen Mishpat, we're talking about Yerodeah. The reason is, the Torah explains, because Choshen Mishpat, you could do whatever you want to me if I'm awful and I let you do this to me or my wealth, though Choshen Mishpat, I could do Mechila. Here when it comes to Ribbis, Mechila, of course I'm awful, I want to borrow money and pay you the interest, still going to be Aser D'Araisa. Newspapers for subscriptions, if you prepay for 12 issues this year, I'll give you a really big discount. What are you in effect doing? You're lending them the value of the next 11. You're paying for the first, and then the 11 future issues, you're prepaying them, and they're giving you a good deal. So you're lending them money, as it were, and they're giving you something in return. Does that does look like interest, and that would be a problem, if not for the fact that that's probably not why they do it. They don't give you this good deal because they want to, they don't give you the good deal because they want to have your cash available. They give you a good deal because they want to lock you in for their readership and their advertising. So Lamaisa will probably be mutter.
Do you have a phrase for that? Like the brocher or something?
That's a miracle. Something can be told later on. A very important application of ribbis d'rabbanan as opposed to daraisa is that ribbis d'rabbanan, the Shulchan Aruch says, you're allowed to lend out Yisomim's money and charge ribbis d'rabbanan. The Shulchan Aruch says, not only Yisomim's money, but any most tzedakah and a shul, and that can be very important when it comes to, for example, Yeshiva University loans. If we're able to knock it down somehow to ribbis d'rabbanan, and if we're going to assume that Yeshiva University is a tzedakah organization, then we will be able to, they will be able to lend money in student loans and charge interest. One way to get something to become ribbis is that you, when the loan was extended, you didn't indicate that there's going to be an interest. But let's say after the loan was already extended, 3 weeks later, the guy didn't pay up. You say, you know, if you don't pay me soon, I'm going to start charging you interest. That would be an example of ribbis that's only in midrabanan. Anytime you do anything that has to do with business, buying and selling, with some late fee or clause for not paying on time, or whenever there's merchandise that was sold and bought, that will always be ribbis d'rabbanan. Ribbis d'oraisa is only going to be in cases of loans. Anything on the bond market, where you're buying and selling shtaros, IOUs, which are bonds, shtaros for whatever reason is also only going to be ribbis d'rabbanan. Whenever you have a check and you're going to be paying things with checks, that if you assume that it's an IOU, like we just said, like a shtar, then it will only be ribbis d'rabbanan. Accordingly, if you take out a student loan from YU and they cut you a check and you're going to pay back with $10,000 plus $800 interest with a check, so that might only be ribbis d'rabbanan because it's done with a check, and which might be a shtar, and therefore, if it's only d'rabbanan, then it could, if we assume that YU is a tzedakah organization, that would permit the money of the tzedakah organization to be lent with ribbis. Now, let's talk about banks. when you have a bank, part of the bank is owned by Jews. Most publicly traded companies are probably owned partially by Jews. So I can't pay interest to Citibank because part of Citibank's owners are Jews, and I'm paying some of the Jews are getting some of the interest, and similarly when I borrow money from them, I'm paying them interest, and when they borrow money from me, meaning when I open up a savings account, they're giving me interest. So how are we going to look at this? So Ramosha Feinstein says that when you have a corporation, there's no shibud haguf on any... When I lend you money, you have a shibud haguf to pay me back. If I lend money to a bank, meaning I put a... I open up a checking or a savings account with them, who's meshubud to pay me back? There's no person who has a shibud haguf. In such a case, the Moshe Feinstein's v'chadesh, that there's no iser for them to give me interest, because I don't have a shibud haguf on anybody. In the other direction, for me to pay interest to them, that would still, there's a shibud haguf on me. I, Uri Orlean, owe whatever, $250,000 to pay for my house mortgage, then I would be usher to give ribis to a corporation. So, how are we going to work out mortgages? How are we going to create situations that I could pay interest without violating a sederaisa of, or drabanan, of ribis? So we have a heteriska. Heteriska in halachikis is palga milva, palga pikadon, which means the following. Let's say I want to lend you $100,000 at 8% interest. So what we really do is we restructure the $100,000 loan for 8% interest into a very different deal, which is not a loan with interest at all. How do I do that? I take $50,000 and I say, here's a free loan of $50,000. Then there's $50,000 that I want to give you to invest. I'm going to be a silent partner. You do the work by making money, opening up a pizza store, opening up or whatever other business you want to open up. I'm going to be your partner on those $50,000. And I expect that those $50,000, I expect it would probably, based on the businesses that you plan on going into, and I know you're a financially astute fellow, you'll probably get a 16% return on that $50,000. By the way, what's a 16% return on $50,000? Well, if 8% on $100,000 is $8,000, so, which is what I wanted. I wanted 8% on $100,000. Now I'm giving you a $50,000, not a loan. I gave you a separate loan. I'll give you $50,000 investment, and you're going to do the work. You're going to do invest the money for me. And I ask for 16%. I'm going to get the $8,000 there. But, of course, that's only if the business goes as we all plan and it works well and you make those that $8,000 profit, that 16% margin of profit on the $50,000 loan. So, I'll tell you what. I expect it's going to be 16% profit. If, of course, it might not be. So, when you pay back the money, you only have to pay back the $50,000 that I bought, but I want you to make sure that you could prove to me, with witnesses, with a shvua chamura d'oraisa, exactly, if you're going to say that it was less than my anticipated, profit margin, you have to prove it to me with beyond a shadow of a doubt. You're going to have to show me every last book and we're going to have to be audited by 12 auditing firms, and you'll have to make a shvua chamura that you made whatever you made. Or I'll tell you what, if you just assume that my guesstimate was right, that you made 16%, then I don't hold you bound to do any of those. You don't have to verify your profit or lack of profits. If you just give me the 16% like I assumed. So what will you do? You'll give me those $50,000 with my 16% interest, which is $8,000. The other half, the loan, well, that was anyway $50,000 you just pay back. So what do I end up with? At the end of the day, $108,000. Was it a loan of $100,000 with an 8% interest? No. There's no interest on any loan. I give you a loan, you give it back to me without anything. And then I became a partner with you, and you didn't want to go through the turmoil of keeping your books and going through an audit and doing a shvua chamur and bezdin, holding a sefer Torah to prove that you only made, let's say, $5 instead of $8,000. So to avoid that headache, you just gave me the $8,000 and assume that that was my profit on, not alone, on a business deal. That's how a heter iska works. Two or three problems with a heter iska is, for example, the whole point of the heter iska is that I'm giving you money to invest and I really don't know how much you made, and you're going to have to sort of give me this money so you don't have to prove how much you made. But if everybody knows how much you made, for example, let's say I give you money to buy a house. Everybody knows what the housing market is. Everybody knows that the housing market plummeted 10% this year. So how can you say it went up 16%? They could look up on Zillow or Trulia exactly what the house is worth now. So how could I ask for that 16% when the house went down in value? So that's going to be one problem with the heter iska in terms of mortgages. Secondly, the whole point of me giving you this money is that I'm investing with you. And that's where you're going to be giving me a return on my own investment, because I'm a silent partner with you. Well, if I give you money to go to college, where's the investment? Where's the business that profited that now I want the return on? Those are two issues that are a problem. One solution, at least in the mortgage situation, is what Rav Aaron Levine, who used to be the Rav Maishul and used to give the class on contemporary halacha for business, and chairman of the economics department here. He liked the following. Whenever you borrow money from a bank for a mortgage, mortgages don't work. You have a fixed rate. I mean, I'm going to pay for the next 30 years of my life, I'm going to be paying $2,000 a month. Now, those $2,000 a month don't mean that you're buying $2,000 more of your house every month. It means that the first month, you're buying $2 of your house, and $1,998 is paying for the interest. So it means who owns your house in that first year? The bank owns all of your house. You own $2 of it. And as the months go, there's a shift. The amortization table shows you, even though you're paying $2,000 a month for every month, there's more of your payment goes towards, as you get longer and longer into the mortgage, goes to paying the principal, and less and less and less goes for paying the interest. But at the very beginning, most of your money is going for the interest, and lesser amounts of that $2,000 monthly payment is going for your actual principal. So if that's the case, who owns your house? The bank owns your house? Well, what do you do when you live in somebody else's house? You pay rent. So whenever you see this mortgage payment that says the word interest, that you're paying them $1,998 interest and $2 for capital, just cross out the word interest and write the word rent. And then what happened? What are you actually doing now? You're buying a house for $2,000 a month. I'm sorry, I'm taking out a loan for $2,000 a month, and part of it is paying back the loan, $2 the first month, $3 the second month, $1,900 the last month. And what's the other amount of money? It's not interest. It's rent for the a part of the house that the bank still owns. Brilliant chap, and you can do the math on your own.
So the student loan doesn't work?
This is for mortgages, only for mortgages. This is for mortgages.
Special star.
Yeah. Mortgages get a special star, correct. Yes. Okay. The last point that we'll talk about, today, is an issue of Rabbanan of Sa B'Sa. When Mida O'Raisa, we said only ribis Ketzutza. Ketzutza means set, designated. I'm lending you $50,000, and I want either 10% interest or $100 a week, however you afford it. That's ribis Ketzutza. But if I lend you $50,000, and you may or may not give me more, that's not Asa D'Oraisa. Let's say I lend you 1,000 pounds of apples, and you'll repay me 1,000 pounds of apples. Midoraisa is nothing wrong, because you gave me 1,000 pounds, and I gave you 1,000 pounds. Let's say the price goes up. Well, if the price goes up, that's going to be a problem, because you end up giving me $1,000 worth of apples for 1,000 pounds, and then it goes up to a little more than a dollar per pound. I'm going to be giving you $1,200 when I return those apples. So because of that shash, that might happen. Chazal said you're never allowed to lend apples, because it might happen that when you repay, they'll be worth more. That's the Issa D'Oraisa, sa of wheat. And that's exactly what the COMEX, the commodity exchange, does. And similarly, when you short stocks, you borrow shares and return shares, that will all be sa b'sa. And therefore, you're going to have to find a heter for sa b'sa. So when you just have simple cases of your, borrowing an egg from your next door neighbor, a half a cup of sugar from your next door neighbor, there, that's really a gift. It's mechila. Some of my next neighbors are here, and they know that we do this. And you don't have to worry. You're going to give back an egg. Maybe when he gives back the egg next week, egg prices are up. No, that's just the mechila. No one really cares. It's a gift. But in terms of like borrowing, you know, 1,000 shares of Apple, that's a lot of money. And paying back 1,000 shares of Apple when you're short of the stock, that could be sabasa. So there are two heterim of sabasa, and that one of them is called yeshlo, meaning if I have any apples, if I have one apple, I could borrow 10,000 pounds of apples and repay you 10,000 pounds of apples because I have one apple. So if you ever do want to borrow 10,000 pounds of apples and you don't have an apple, you know what you could do? Ask for a gift or buy one apple from him. And then borrow the other 9,999 apples. You could borrow and repay those 9,999 apples because you had yeshlo. Another one is yotza hashara. If there's a set price in the market already established for this item, then you're able also, there's no issur d'rabbanan for whatever reason, of sabasa. Just two halacha ma'aseh points, and then we're going to finish for the day, for the semester. Let's say you have a father-in-law who's very nice to you. He's going to, you want to buy a house, and you don't have any credit rating. So you're not going to be able to get a loan or get a good rate on your loan. So he'll be nice enough, and he'll take out the loan. But you live in the house. You'll send in the mortgage checks. So it sounds wonderful, right? Well, the problem is, who really borrowed the money? You didn't borrow the money for your house. Your father borrowed the money from Mr. Citibank. Then your father lent that money that he borrowed from Mr. Citibank to you. And when you pay that loan, what's happening? When you repay the mortgage, you're not paying Citibank. You're paying your father because only your father is the account holder. You're paying back your father, and your father is paying the mortgage to Citibank. So that means your father, on the second half of the deal, your father lent you money, and you're paying him back money with interest. That could be Yisurim, possibly Daraisa, and that's very serious. This is another Rab didn't mention, but it is very important, Halacha Maisa. If you do the same thing with a credit card, if, let's say, I don't have a good credit line, so I want to charge something, people are nice, your brother will let you want to buy a car for $5,000. So you don't have $5,000 cash, and you don't have a credit line. So you'll use your brother's credit card to borrow the money, and you just make the payments on your brother's credit card. The same thing just happened. Your brother was the one who borrowed the $5,000 because he's the name on the card. So he borrowed the money from American Express. Then he lent it to you. When you're paying off his bill, when you're paying his bill for the credit card that you used from him, you're really doing what? You're not paying the only one who pays American Express is the one whose name is on the card. You're really paying him back, and he's going to go ahead and pay American Express. So the second half of the deal is that he lent you money, you're paying him back money with interest. That will be an Isser of Ribbis, possibly Daraisa. And with this, we conclude the semester. Yashar Koach. Thank you, Rabbi Osai. Hatzlacha Rabba. The Bechina will be in Mir Hashem on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. There will be a makeup exam for those who can't, about 2 to 3 weeks from this coming Tuesday, somewhere in the middle of June or at the beginning of June, not on a Tuesday. So, that's Lacha. Thank you so much.